the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the Newsline.
Almost 2 years after African-American George Floyd died beneath the knee of a white police officer on a street in Minneapolis, the police officers involved are being brought to account. A federal jury has found three former officers present at the scene of Floyd's arrest guilty of depriving the man of his civil rights. The jury found the conduct of the three officers led to Floyd's death, a charge that would impact the final verdict the officers will face. The three are convicted of failing to stop Derek Chauvin, who knelt on Floyd's neck for about 9 minutes, and denying Floyd's constitutional right to medical care while in custody. Tu Tao, Alexander Quang, and Thomas Lane will remain free on bail until their hearings, which aren't scheduled yet. What's for certain is that they'll face several years in prison. Chauvin, the officer arresting Floyd, was sentenced to 22 and a half years last year. For Floyd's family, it's not enough.
This is just accountability. It can never be justice because I can never get George back. And no matter how many times that I pray at night and I think about my brother 24/7, it still is going to be hard, even though we just had a federal conviction and we already had the state conviction. But times, you know, will be probably a lot harder for me still because I can't get my brother back.
The trials are considered historic in the U.S., where officers are hardly ever indicted for the treatment of the members of the black community. Racism in the United States dates back as long as its history. African Americans have suffered tremendous atrocities at the hands of white slave owners over the years, and the impact it made on American society can be observed to this day. One of the early cases of police racism can be traced back to the early 1700s when South Carolina launched America's first law enforcement force, dubbed the Slave Patrol. As the title suggests, the patrols were tasked with hunting down black people and selling them into slavery. Following a devastating civil war, slavery in the U.S. was abolished in 1865, but the results the anti-slavery camp was looking for didn't come to pass. Wealthy plantation owners in the South found loopholes in the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and created what later became known as the Black Codes, the rules and regulations that appeared to have acknowledged the abolition but created the same slavery conditions in essence. Among the many racist provisions in the codes is the criminalization of vagrancy for black people. This meant that law enforcement was free to arrest and charge any black person who didn't have a job. The codes were a precursor to Jim Crow laws, which enforced racial segregation in the South and lasted until the mid-20th century. The recent killings and mistreatment of the black people are reminiscent of the lynching of African Americans and the destruction of their properties by the Ku Klux Klan and other hate groups throughout the years.
I guess the main root is, you know, this country has been founded on a system of white supremacy, racism, and genocide. It's founded on a system of inequality with a purpose, right? Racism with a purpose. The purpose is to create a group of second class citizens who the country can feed off of, right? We can feed off of their labor, we can feed off of their work, we can feed off of their existence.
U.S. President Joe Biden staked much of his presidency on a promise to fight racism in the country, managing to garner the support from a large portion of the African American society. But with many lawmakers balking at even the idea of police reforms, can the president make good on his pledge
you know, police reform and police brutality is a big issue for black and brown folks and for poor and working class folks here in the United States. But the U.S. politicians don't represent those people or those interests in this country. They represent a rich interest, the rich interest of the ruling class. And so, you know, they're not interested in police reform. So this bill, you know, essentially has died in the Senate and will probably never get passed because of the fact that, you know, there's no interest by U.S. policymakers to get it passed. There's no interest to do what the citizens want them to do.
George Floyd wasn't the first African-American who lost his life over what could otherwise be considered as an inconsequential offense for a white person, and certainly has not been the last. But the waves of scrutiny such cases bring up in their wake are indeed making a positive, albeit limited, impact.
Vienna's Palais Coburg Hotel, the venue of marathon talks between Iran and the P4+1 group. It has once again become the center of a lot of attention as parties involved in the tough negotiations have signaled significant progress despite the complexity of some issues. The eighth round, which began on December 27th, has now become one of the longest rounds of talks between Iran and the P4+1, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany. Iran and the P4+1 are completing a draft text of an agreement to revive the 2015 deal. Most of the delegations acknowledge that the talks have reached a critical stage. The diplomacy seems to be approaching a make-or-break moment. Iran's lead negotiator says being near the finish line does not guarantee crossing it. Ali Bagheri-Kani says it requires extra caution, much perseverance, additional creativity, and a balanced approach to take the last step. The Iranian diplomat points out that to finish the job, there are certain decisions that the Western parties to the negotiations need to take.
Thus far, the West has been reluctant to make any sweeping political decisions that are necessary to bring the United States back into the plan. Iran isn't just going to forget the very many U.S. and Western provocations since the United States left the plan in 2018, and they understand that there are many political camps competing at once for power. The West needs to make sweeping political decisions that will definitively outline the future of U.S. involvement in the plan.
Iran says its initiatives pave the way for the progress in the negotiations and that a good deal is within reach in the Austrian capital. Tehran believes that the ball is now in the West's court, and if it shows serious determination, a good deal can emerge. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says Tehran seeks a lasting deal, not a fragile one. The president has noted that credible guarantees, putting an end to political claims and effective removal of sanctions are necessary for a lasting deal with the P4+1 group. But what are the characteristics of a lasting deal? The 2015 deal lasted a few years only. Even during the years that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was in place, Iran had serious grievances about its implementation by Western parties. It complained that it was not receiving the economic benefits it was entitled to. And Iran seems to have learned a lesson from how the hard-earned international agreement unraveled. Since the beginning of the talks in Vienna last year, Iran has insisted that America must remove all sanctions imposed on Tehran after former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out from the deal in May 2018 in a verifiable manner. It has also demanded that Washington provide guarantees that it will not leave the JCPOA again.
Iran wants credible guarantees from the United States because the U.S. has failed to provide any critical guarantees, any credible guarantees since the beginning of these negotiations. When the JCPOA was first being planned and negotiated back in 2015, the United States made a commitment to diplomacy and peace. Yet, in 2018, they proved that that commitment was not a guarantee by dropping out after the change of an administration. So what we find is that when Iran is talking to the United States and other Western nations that change their administrations often, and those administrations are subject to changing their positions from the last administration, then you find that Iran doesn't have any solid guarantees.
Iran says America's maximum pressure campaign has failed, and its credibility has been seriously deterred. Observers believe Washington now has to take measures to compensate for its past mistakes and regain the trust of the international community.
The Israeli regime has carried out yet another attack on the Syrian capital Damascus' countryside, killing three soldiers. Syria's state television carried the report early on Thursday, specifying the assault as a missile attack. Various media outlets had earlier reported that Syria's air defenses had confronted an Israeli airstrike around Damascus. The official Syrian Arab news agency, Sana, said a number of explosions had rung out over the skies of the capital and its outskirts. This is the Israeli regime's fourth attack on the Syrian soil within the space of just 2 weeks.
They consider they have the military, the diplomatic edge, and really every solution for the Israelis is not peace, but it's a technical ability to dominate and control the Palestinians.
Just a day earlier, the Arab country said the regime had launched a missile attack on various targets on the outskirts of Syria's southwestern city of Quneitra near Syria's Tel Aviv-occupied Golan Heights. Last week, the occupying regime targeted areas surrounding Damascus and the western city of Homs.
Well, Israel pays no attention to international law. It doesn't even, I don't think, make a pretense of it. It violates international law every day in regard to the airspace of Lebanon, the airspace of Syria, the rights of the Palestinian people, and of course in its threats against Iran.
Israel frequently targets military positions inside Syria, especially those of the resistance movement Hezbollah, which has played a key role in helping the Syrian army in its fight against the foreign-backed terrorists. Tel Aviv regime claims that its attacks target alleged supplies that are headed for the Lebanese resistance movement of Hezbollah. On countless occasions, though, the strikes have targeted reinforcement belonging to Syria's military and its allies. Tel Aviv mostly keeps quiet about its attacks on Syrian territories. Many view them as a knee-jerk reaction to the Syrian government's increasing success in confronting terrorism.
Is that Israel seeks to be the lone superpower, or you could say mini superpower, of the region as a junior partner of the big superpower, the United States. It wishes to be the dominant military force that actually exists as a country in the region. And I think that that's really what's going on here. It has nothing to do with international law, which is, as I said, Israel ignores.
Israel has been a key supporter of terrorist groups that have opposed the government of President Bashar al-Assad since the foreign-backed militancy erupted in Syria in March 2011.
Our position on the status of the Golan Heights is well known, and we would like to make it clear that this position has not changed. In line with international law and relevant Security Council resolutions, notably Resolution 242 and 497, we do not recognize Israel's sovereignty over the territories occupied by Israel since June 1967, including the Golan Heights, and we do not consider them to be part of the territory of the State of Israel. Annexations of territory by force is prohibited under international law.
Syria and the Israeli regime are technically at war due to the latter's continued occupation of the Golan. The Israeli regime maintains a significant military presence in the territory, which it uses as one of its launch pads for attacks against the Syrian soil.
Britain has sought to restore its influence and colonial rule in West Asia by pursuing aggressive and interventionist policies in the region. UK's first direct military involvement, the 21st century, began in Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks. UK officials beat the drums of war. Then Prime Minister Tony Blair, who was referred to as George W. Bush's poodle, played a key role in paving the way for UK's militarism. It has now emerged that British forces committed war crimes in Afghanistan. Documents show senior military officers buried evidence that British troops were executing detainees in Afghanistan. UK Special Forces officers killed unarmed Afghans who posed no threats. In 2003, London followed Washington's lead in accusing Iraq's former regime of possessing weapons of mass destruction.
So that was the UK's role, was to provide cover for the Americans. And of course, the Americans, the UK sees America as a means of getting a sort of protection, getting the big brother on their side, which they've, you know, following on from their experiences in 1945, the British establishment have a terrific fear of being left on their own to face a major continental enemy.
The UK, alongside the US, invaded Iraq without the UN mandate. British forces were primarily stationed in southern Iraq. British soldiers tortured hundreds of Iraqi detainees between 2003 and 2009. But no action was taken to hold the British government accountable for the war crimes that it committed there. Following the invasion of Iraq, an inquiry team was set up to investigate Britain's military intervention in the Arab nation. The Chilcot report said the UK chose to invade Iraq before peaceful options had been exhausted. It also said the former UK Premier, Blair, exaggerated the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. It also said that Blair ignored warnings on what would happen in Iraq after its invasion.
We have concluded that the UK chose to join the invasion of Iraq before the peaceful options for disarmament had been exhausted. Military action at that time was not a last resort.
London is one of Saudi Arabia's staunch supporters. UK-made weapons are used by the Saudi regime against the Yemeni people. The UK is one of Saudi Arabia's leading arms suppliers, along with the US. It is also a major supplier of arms to the United Arab Emirates, another country in the coalition that is bombing Yemen. The UK has continued to support airstrikes by Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners. It has provided both arms and ongoing maintenance and support, in spite of overwhelming evidence of repeated breaches of international humanitarian law by the coalition.
Well, its colonial interest is historical. I don't believe that anyone is trying to get Lawrence of Arabia back into the peninsula anymore. I don't think the British, even the most purblind British, don't think they can recreate the empire.
The UK-made equipment used in the war includes Typhoon and Tornado aircraft, Paveway bombs, and Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles. The published value of UK arm licenses for export to the Saudi-led coalition since the bombing began in 2015, in March, is £8.4 billion. However, estimates showed that the real value of arms to Saudi Arabia is over £20 billion, while the value of sales to the coalition as a whole is over £22 billion.
Such hideous weaponry, and we are actually inviting oppressive regimes and dictatorships to come and buy this weaponry, knowing that it will be used against the people of Palestine, knowing it's going to be dropped on the heads of the people of Yemen, is appalling.
It is now believed that given the U.S. withdrawal from the West Asia region, or minimal presence, the U.K. is moving in to replace the U.S. while pursuing to restore its colonial influence and role in the West Asia region.
In the limelight. As the month of Ramadan approaches, all the conditions for another explosion are still in place, says Awad Abdul Fattah Ryder in an article published under the heading, Why Sheikh Jarrah and Al-Aqsa Could Ignite a New Intifada. Stay tuned for more. On February 14th, Haaretz published an article with the headline, The East Jerusalem Flashpoint That Could Ignite the Entire Middle East. In it, the journalist Nir Hassoun wrote, Sheikh Jarrah had, again, become the site of violent clashes, just as it did before last year's war. Other Israelis cited similar concerns. The Zionist regime's prime minister, Naftali Bennett, himself a right-wing settler, warned far-right Knesset member Itamar Ben-Gvir, who earlier this month set up a makeshift parliamentary office in a tent on Palestinian land in Sheikh Jarrah, that his actions could cause chaos. Bennett on February 14 said, We don't need provocations from people on either side inflaming tensions for political interest. Given the latest raid by the Zionist settlers on the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah and the violent clashes with its Palestinian inhabitants that followed, the Zionist regime's officials and media's concerns about replicating last May's almost unprecedented Palestinian uprising do not seem far-fetched. As Ramadan approaches once again, beginning at the start of April, there is a huge potential for conflict to erupt around possible Zionist restrictions on Palestinian access to parts of the Old City and Al-Aqsa Mosque during the Muslim Holy Month. Ben-Gvir's act in Sheikh Jarrah, where 27 families have been fighting eviction since 2008, led to violent clashes between the Palestinian families and their supporters and the Zionist regime's security forces. Several protesters were injured while others were arrested. It is this strong resistance by the Palestinian families to the recent assaults by the settlers that has caused Israeli alarm, especially since this renewed local resistance has also brought pressure from Al-Quds-based international diplomats. In the past few months, some Israeli circles held the belief that the popular resistance in Sheikh Jarrah had been exhausted by a number of factors, including the continued Israeli siege of the neighborhood. But the Zionist regime's apparent desire to avoid further confrontation with Palestinians doesn't stem from humanitarian reasons, and Bennett's criticism of Ben-Gvir's provocative conduct is not because the prime minister is any less extreme or aggressive about denying the Palestinian right to self-determination. Rather, it is because, firstly, Bennett sees Ben-Gvir's behavior as directed against his cabinet as part of his infighting within the settlers' camp, split as it is over former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the corruption charges he's facing. Secondly, Bennett is not interested in any disruptions that might embarrass his new allies. For Bennett, especially on the Arab and international scene, things seem to be going pretty well. On the domestic front, he's determined to fight off continued attempts from the right-wing opposition to bring his government down. So the Palestinians are paying the price twice, firstly from the ongoing and brutal settler colonial ethnic cleansing project, secondly from infighting between the two camps over whoever can be more brutal in implementing the cleansing plans. Last year, almost no one had been expecting scenes of the popular uprising like the ones we witnessed in East Al-Quds, especially centered around one small neighborhood. It was thought impossible that Palestinian resistance could overcome the huge obstacles that have been placed before it physically, with the high separation walls that had been erected, making it difficult to unite Palestinians in one fighting front, and politically, with the security cooperation with the Israeli colonizer. That doesn't mean we will necessarily see another intifada of the same scope and intensify during the upcoming holy month of Ramadan, even though all of the conditions for another explosion are still in place. It could happen before Ramadan, or it could be months or years from now. But one thing is certain. As long as the apartheid settler colonial regime of Israel continues with its injustices, brutalities, and atrocities, the Palestinian people will continue to resist. In recent years, we've seen the emergence of a young generation, creative and brilliant at organizing. They are skilled in using social media to overcome geographic and social fragmentation and reaching out to all Palestinians, wherever they are, as well as to the world. These young people have decided not to wait for traditional leadership to save them, as it has proven incompetent. The birthing of a new leadership is underway. This will take years and will require much endeavor and sacrifice, but that's what the future holds for them, with no other savior in sight. The many minor uprisings, which are led by the youth, are the driving force behind the human rights organizations framing the Zionist regime as an apartheid regime. The Israeli apartheid regime might have a strong relations economically and in terms of security with world regimes. But global civil society is undergoing a significant opinion shift against the fake regime of Israel. At every popular intifada, with every military deployment against Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip, the Zionist regime comes under fire from global civil society organizations. This is what disturbs the Israeli regime. The Palestinians, and especially the young activists, are confident that the South African moment is coming sooner or later. This hope is what fuels their passion in the struggle for a free Palestine, where justice and equality can prevail on the ruins of the immoral and inhuman settler colonial entity.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is your host Musa Al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and other issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are based upon the Holy Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all, supplemented by scientific data and facts. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend and Islamic researcher, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi from the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today, dear listeners, we will be continuing our discussion on how we should grow confidence in our children. Previously, we mentioned, for example, that one of the things that we as parents can do to inspire this self-confidence and to build on it in our children is to choose a good name for them, a virtuous name, and also to provide a safe environment for them, and also to make them feel and make them know that they are in a safe environment and they have emotional and physical and all kinds of support that they can always find at their parents. So, dear Sayyid, what other ways can we as parents utilize to inspire even more confidence in our children?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. So we said in order for us to increase self-confidence in our kids, there are things that we should do and things that we should not do. Among the things that we should not do, we should not give our children a bad adjective. We should not call them and name them something that is negative, which sometimes we don't seem to be able to get rid of this bad habit where we constantly call them like weak, not being able to do this, I don't know, you're stupid, you're this. And so we have plenty, we have a long list of negative attributes that we can attribute to our kids in their daily life and, you know, and them doing their chores or doing their work. That is something that parents should stay away from, because the more you give negative attributes, the more they sink in that child and the more he acts upon them, and it will make them definitely have low self-esteem.
And just to stress on a point that I've heard many times being made regarding this is that some people think this is criticism. That this is constructive criticism.
Well, there's nothing about constructive about calling a person a criticism. Negative attribute. I mean, if I want to give you constructive criticism, I have to, you know, there's a mistake that we can try to fix. Not by calling you names. If I call a person an idiot or stupid or a weakling or a dork, I mean, what constructive criticism in that? The only thing is in this is me getting my own satisfaction at getting a chew.
Yeah. So let's keep that in mind.
Yeah. So we say these things that people need to stay away from completely. Another thing that we need to do with our children to increase their self-esteem is actually giving them chances to do things.
Right. Let's expand on that after a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing different manners we can use to inspire confidence in our children. Now, just before we went on a break, dear Sayyid, you said that we should let our children do things. Now, what do you mean by that?
Now, with children, because in life, everything for them is a trial and error. They do things, they fail, they do things, they fail, and they learn. Right. Now, some parents, sadly, when the children do something and they fail, they never give them the chance to repeat that same failure again and again until they learn from it.
Right.
Not every child learns from the same mistake. Sometimes you might find a child who puts in his hand in fire and he gets burnt and he feels the pain. And you can see that he might repeat that same thing again, maybe a few days later, because that hasn't sunk in his mind yet.
Right.
So you see that kids sometimes throughout their life, even when they become, at teenagers, they will make certain mistakes.
Of course.
The idea is to give them a chance to make that mistake and learn from it. Some people don't do that to their children. Now, that giving them chances to do things again and again, either be it for something good or for something bad that they've done, it gives them the confidence that they require in obviously becoming better people, which increases their confidence, which is what we
also helps
seeking.
With their ambition as well and with their tenacity in a good way, because yeah. if they are taught firsthand that trial and error, but you got to keep going, then they will adapt this mentality and carry it out throughout their entire lives.
True. And another thing that we need to do for our children in order to increase their confidence is let them be have self-reliance. They rely on themselves to do things. If the child wants to dress himself, let them. If the child wants to wear his own shoe, let them. If the child wants to make his own, food or whatever, let them. Give them that self-confidence in themselves in making things.
We did discuss this before about how it is good that they want to be independent.
Exactly. We'll discuss this in more details. So we need to give them the opportunity to become self-reliant and do things for themselves. That will definitely increase their self-confidence. Also, putting laws for children, like a map that they have to work through throughout the day. These are the things that need to be done. These are the things that shouldn't be done, and so on and so forth. So the child grows with order rather than chaos. Chaos never gives us order. So we have to make sure that the child, when he sees order in the house and in his life, it grows his self-confidence that I can do this, I can do that, I can do this, I can do that. So the more he does them or she does them, the more confidence they will become. So this is also something that we need to keep in mind. Another thing that we should not do is not to put too much restraining condition and orders on the kids. Now, sometimes our don'ts are much more than our do's when it comes to children, or should be vice versa, or at least it should be an equal amount.
Right, and with that, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing ways we can use as parents to inspire self-confidence and self-reliance in our children. Now, Said, just before we went on a break, you said that we shouldn't restrain them too much. And what exactly does that entail?
We saying that sometimes as parents, we ask our children not to do so many things, and even sometimes simple things. For example, don't open the fridge.
Yeah.
Don't eat the fruits. Don't do, you know, this. Don't sit on this chair. And like things that child can do. And if he does them, there'll be no harm in doing. And I've seen this on a first account where some of the mothers, for example, they tell the children, for example, not to eat certain fruits or certain sweets or certain foods, and even though they are right in front of them. Now, either the mother, for example, is trying to teach her child to behave himself, or she's trying to tell her child to have self-control.
Right.
But it's not appropriate. It's not the right time to impose these things on a child when he is just a child and there's something in front of him. So we end up asking our children not to do a lot of things. So whether when it comes to their rooms, when it comes to them sitting around with us, when it comes to dealing with people outside, when it comes to them walking outside, when it comes to every matter of their life, you see that we put too much don'ts and less do's. Okay? And that obviously will lower the more don'ts we put. It's a condition, it's a lock, it's a chain that will obviously lower their self-esteem. So we're saying, obviously, when there's something wrong, put a don't on it. If it's something wrong with something haram. But if something allowed, something permissible, something they can do,
you try to lessen these downs, turn it into an advice. It's better not to eat too much food, for example. It's better not to eat junk. It's better not to eat that. But don't make it a condition that you should not eat this.
Right, like, so do not force them.
Yeah, like not a wristband.
Let them take their decision. Let them decide on their own.
Mm-hmm. So we're saying always the less condition there are, the more self-confidence they will have. Another thing that helps and increases the confidence of a child is your monitoring to the child.
Right.
When the child feels that he's monitored by his parents and they are not letting him loose or at least to be by himself, he feels more confident. And not only that you need to be monitoring the child, but at the same time that you need to intervene at the right moment. Some people, they monitor their children and they just jump at the first instant that they think the child is going to make a mistake or going to do something wrong. Now we say, no, that's not the appropriate time. Let them be. If the mistake is not, you know, a great mistake or a big mistake, sometimes we said, we'll let it pass.
Of course, it goes without saying. They say that when we say monitor, because some people don't think monitor, they think about completely controlling the child.
No, not self-control, no. Of course not.
No, because then it becomes a horrible presence instead of a safe and reassuring
presence.
Exactly.
When you say monta, it's like when you're saying monta, for example, their akhlaq, their behavior, who they talk with, who they deal with, what they do online.
So be the,
things that might have devastating effect on them.
These be the counselor, I'd rather say.
Yeah.
Be the advisor.
Exactly. So either way, be know what your kids are up to and get involved and intervene at the right time. At any time, at the right time.
And on that note, we will have to end today's program because we are out of time. I thank the dear Sayyid for his insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback, or some comments, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. You can also find us on various social media websites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Rejecting pressure to terminate the program in its entirety, the Biden administration has recently announced it is redesigning a Trump-era experiment that physicians and progressive lawmakers have criticized as a scheme to fully privatize Medicare. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading Critics Blast Biden, Rebrand of Trump's Medicare Privatization Scheme. This is the story. Rejecting pressure to terminate the program in its entirety, the Biden administration has recently announced it is redesigning a Trump-era experiment that physicians and progressive lawmakers have criticized as a scheme to fully privatize Medicare. Instead of ending what's known as the direct contracting model, which the Trump administration officially launched in 2020, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, gave the program a new name, ACO REACH, which stands for Accountable Care Organization Realizing Equity Access and Community Health. In addition to the name change and fresh veneer, a step in line with the healthcare industry's call for a rebranding, CMS said the program will now span 4 years instead of eight and will include requirements aimed at ensuring transparency and equity. The changes are slated to take effect on January 1, 2023. Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP, a doctor-led group that has spearheaded the opposition to direct contracting, was far from satisfied with the Biden administration's changes, which the organization argued are more cosmetic than substantive. Dr. Susan Rogers, an internal medicine physician and president of PNHP, said, ACO REACH is direct contracting in disguise. This new model doubles down on direct contracting fatal flaws, inserting a profit-seeking middleman between beneficiaries and their providers. Under direct contracting, so-called direct contracting entities were paid monthly by CMS to cover a specified portion of a patient's medical care. DCs, the majority of which are currently controlled by investors, not healthcare providers, are allowed to pocket funds they didn't spend on care. In a statement, PNHP, which has implored the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, to fully halt the program, outlined how the revamped pilot perpetuates the dangerous flaws of the Trump administration's direct contracting experiment. First, like the DC model, ACO REACH will pay middlemen a flat fee to manage seniors' health, allowing them to keep 40% of what they don't spend on care as profit and overhead. Next, traditional Medicare beneficiaries will still be automatically enrolled into ACO REACH entities without their full understanding or consent, and once enrolled cannot opt out of an ACO REACH entity unless they change primary care providers. Like DCs, the ACO REACH program has virtually no limits on what type of company can participate. Entities can be owned by commercial insurers, private equity investors, and other profit-seeking firms, including current direct contracting entities. The new program increases provider governance from 25% to 75% with loopholes built into application process. But ACO-rich entities are ultimately accountable to investors. You can't slap a Band-Aid on a tumor and call it cured, said Rogers. Direct contracting and now ACO-rich threatens the health of beneficiaries and the future of traditional Medicare. As physicians committed to the health of our patients, we urge HHS to abandon this rebranding effort and focus the agency's efforts towards strengthening and protecting traditional Medicare. CMS unveiled its raft of changes to the Medicare experiment just over a week after a coalition of industry groups, including active participants in the direct contracting program, requested that the Biden administration fix the model instead of ending it. The industry organization suggested that a rebranding and name change would help communicate how this model is part of the evolution to accountable care. CMS is headed by Elizabeth Fowler, who has previously worked at WellPoint Incorporation, now known as Anthem, one of the largest private health insurance companies in the United States. While CMS said recently that it took into account feedback received from participants and stakeholders, the new ACO REACH program is more in line with industry demands than those of physicians, grassroots advocacy groups, and progressive lawmakers. Changing the name doesn't change the fact that the direct contracting program is backdoor privatization of Medicare, Alex Lawson, executive director of Social Security Works, said in a statement, adding, "This dangerous experiment must be stopped before it further harms the health of vulnerable seniors, eats into Medicare Trust Fund, and destroys traditional Medicare." Lawson added, "DCs and their investors, which include private equity firms, are focused on generating profits. They are incentivized to deny and delay care as much as possible." There are no changes that can address that fundamental flaw at the heart of the program. President Biden must protect older adults and people with disabilities by ending the direct contracting program immediately. Representative Pramila Jayapal, who earlier this month led more than 50 House Democrats in urging Biden to cut off the program, said recently that she will continue to fight tooth and nail against any and all efforts to privatize Medicare. Trump-era direct contracting is a major threat to Medicare coverage hidden in bureaucracy, said Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. "While I'm glad to see the administration taking steps to redesign this flawed program, I'm disappointed that these changes will not be enacted for 10 months and that there are no limits on how many seniors are funneled into this experimental model. More needs to be done."
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, and other life forms. You are listening to Youth Station, brought to you by RRB English Radio. There are many other opening alternatives to this, but no, that's not my job. Anyway, today I have the honor of being joined by my brother in faith and humanity, Brother Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so very much for being with us, sir. What makes a role model, really?
What makes a role model? A role model is what he stands for.
What do you mean?
Why do we love the Justice League?
Why do we love the Justice League? You know, the thing about the Justice League is that, or the Avengers, or all these superheroes that we have, is that they have been, to a great extent, I personally feel, pushed. They are being pushed
under the notion that they stand for something that me and you relate to, which is...
They stand for being cool.
No, beside that. That's what I'm trying to get. First is what they stand for, which is to save humanity, to save life, to create justice on earth, to create better life for people, to save people. That's what they do. That's the core value that they stand for. They get pushed into me and you by giving them the extra values.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. See, here's the thing about the Justice League. When I think about it, not just the Justice League, that's this whole superhero concept that... the West is so... Well, not actually the West. We have it in almost every culture. They are so keen on having people celebrate. Is that, you know, like the likes of Justice League. Sure, when there's an alien invasion of planet Earth, you see them practicing their superpowers and kicking tush and, you know, creating so much more carnage through this process.
Yeah, yeah,
like totally sure. Raising New York City to the ground. But like when there's a mother and her child starving in the back alleys of Brooklyn or the Bronx because, you know, she can't keep up with rent, where's the justice in that? You know, it's the Justice League is not at all...
I'm not saying they are...
A logical...
Exactly. I agree with you
but
100%.
It is so accepted and celebrated because Hollywood especially has done such a great job at pushing it down consumers' throats.
Exactly. I'm saying it's now, but I'm trying to say is that even Hollywood or any other media outlet, when they want to present something to you, regardless of what's actually happening in the actual world,
mm-hmm.
is they try to give you a core value that you could relate to, right? Now, when it's human invasion, yes, true. Okay, you know, our problem are the aliens, and we don't care. Even if thousands of people get killed in the process, we don't care as long as we get to save Earth. So, yes, so that's a value. So what makes them heroes and what makes role models is what they believe in, right? And we could relate to that to some extent. Obviously, and me and you, because we understand this concept, so we don't go towards that 100%. As for us, when we want to take a role model in, is we have to look at what they believe in and what they stand for is what makes them role model. And then when I use the Avengers or the Justice League, they are just example. But across out every culture, they would have a character or characters